Welcome back to TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host and THR's chief TV critic, Dan Feinberg. Dan, how you doing, my friend?
Oh, just preparing for the start of the Jewish high holidays, Leslie. So Shana Tova to all of our Jewish listeners and happy Constitution Day to all of our ultra-American listeners.
And happy Dodgers clinched the playoff berth to all of our baseball fans. Well, wait, that's just me.
That's not true. It could be me also, and it's definitely at least five or six of our listeners.
Maybe less. Well, let's dive into this week's headlines. Enough about baseball. What do you think, Dan?
By all means.
Leading off, Norman Lear is back in business at Netflix, this time with an animated reboot of his beloved sitcom Good Times, with Seth MacFarlane and NBA star Steph Curry exec producing.
In SNL news, Jim Carrey will play Joe Biden in the upcoming season, which has also added three new featured players to its cast. The show will return in October with a limited studio audience, and the entire regular cast will return after Kate McKinnon inked a new deal to return.
Over at HBO Max, the streamer has handed out a straight-to-series order for Our Flag Means Death, a period pirate drama from Taika Waititi and People of Earth's David Jenkins. HBO Max has also renewed Raised by Wolves and Doom Patrol. The latter will no longer stream on DC Universe.
In unsurprising but still pleasant late-night news, HBO has renewed Last Week Tonight with John Oliver through 2023, while Showtime has picked up Desus and Mero for a third season.
Blackish star Tracy Ellis Ross has also signed an overall deal with AB Signature, further solidifying her relationship with the studio behind the comedy.
And in casting shakeups, Jeremy Tardy has exited Netflix's Dear White People and called out producers Lionsgate for, quote, shameful practices of discrimination.
Over at ABC, the network has canceled mid-season comedy United We Fall after one season. Points if you can tell me what that show is about and who was in it.
Well,
Dan,
I mean,
you reviewed it, so that's cheating. But if you know what the show is without looking it up, show me a tweet.
Yeah, everyone can just pour one out for United We Fall. And also the TCA award winners were announced this week, with Watchmen sweeping all four categories in which it was nominated, including new show, which it should not have been eligible for. But it also won the coveted Program of the Year. Schitt's Creek took home two wins, including Catherine O'Hara and Outstanding Achievement in Comedy, while Succession was recognized as Drama Series. It's a pretty good list of winners, other than that, again, Watchmen should not have been eligible for new series because it is a limited series. Anywho,
and before we get into this week's top five, we bring you a special Headlines Plus segment. This week, the long-awaited rebranding of CBS All Access came into focus. The platform will be rebranded as Paramount Plus. Yes, really. Sometime in 2021. They've also picked up a scripted limited series about the making of The Godfather, a new show from Yellowstone creator Taylor Sheridan, and a docuseries called The Real Criminal Minds that's inspired by the former CBS procedural. What's more, they're developing a revival of The Game and pulling content from pretty much every corner of the Viacom CBS portfolio. And they have a reimagined take on MTV's Behind the Music in the works and so much more. So it's basically, consider this like a little bonus segment here, Dan.
Or an extra long headline. But then again, we knew this was coming. The only thing we didn't know for sure was what the name or title of the platform was going to be, and congratulations on choosing the least inspired possible name for the platform. So,
yeah, but it's also not a surprise considering when the company rebranded Spike TV a few years ago, they did a bunch of research and found that the Paramount name was synonymous with quality, and that's why they rebranded it as Paramount Network. So the film studio is really well known. It's really not a surprise here.
Anyway, it's just yet another streaming service that the folks will ask you to pay for, and
You're already paying. Most people are already paying for it, right? Or 8 million people or 10 million people, whatever the number is.
Who even knows? It's all confusing. I use CBS All Access mostly so that I can watch Love Island without commercials. So I am truly getting my money's worth out of that particular platform.
Yeah, but it's basically now with all these additions from across the portfolio, it's basically kind of morphing into Disney Plus meets a little bit of Peacock. So
it's still, though, you know, it's a, once again, it's kind of confusing various different brands, and it's going to confuse audiences because Paramount does indeed maybe speak to quality movies, but it doesn't necessarily, to me, instantly speak to, I don't know, CBS All Access, to the Viacom portfolio. It's a bunch of things that do not immediately click over in my mind. So it's yet another thing that is going to cause users to scratch their heads and be generally perplexed. But, you know, it sounds like they'll have a lot of content and some of those new things, including the Godfather behind the scenes making of limited series, sound interesting. So I'll want to watch them, but it's, I don't know. It's all putting more weight on consumers to keep up with the changing marketplace that is increasingly less convenient to consumers.
Right. But it does also get them away from the brand recognition of CBS, which was important to kind of broaden that portfolio out to beyond the, you know, we're the home for procedurals that your parents and grandparents watch.
Pros and cons, Leslie. Pros and cons.
Yes. Well, with all that out of the way, let's dive into this week's top five.
Number one.
Leading off this week, the 72nd Emmys have arrived, and while there's always a healthy debate about who will win versus who should win, this year the biggest question seems to be about how the actual telecast is going to work. Jimmy Kimmel will host the ceremony, which will air live on ABC. The telecast will feature nearly 140 stars from more than 110 locations. Cameras were deployed to stars' homes. So much is going on. With the remote production, it promises to be more more unpredictable than ever. And joining us this week to break down what to expect from the show is THR senior writer Michael O'Connell. Thanks for joining us, Mikey.
Hi.
So, Mikey, you had a great interview in the magazine and available at THR.com with Reginald Hudlund, who is one of the producers of the show. First of all, in your interview, you say that he's Reggie to his friends. Do you feel like you're his friend yet? Let's go with that first.
Well, that was actually edited for space. It originally said Reggie to both people in and out of his esteemed circle. Everyone calls him Reggie. He's such a lovely man. So, yes, I do call him Reggie, and I believe anyone could.
Excellent. Then I will, too. I liked that they're sort of using as their mantra the question, what could go wrong? Talk about how that is playing itself into this entire telecast and its ethos.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to what could go wrong is absolutely everything. This is and they're leaning into that, which is so nice, because it's so often there is a there's an ego attached to events like this, and we've got it under control, and they're being really loose with it. They're acknowledging that this is kind of experimental and that a number of things could go wrong. But the main issue is that Jimmy Kimmel is obviously anchoring this from the Staples Center, but there are over 100 remote feeds from people's homes and other venues across the globe. And the main concern is that these feeds aren't going to work every time. The worst case scenario being a deadline for someone who actually wins, which on top of being embarrassing would also be kind of sad because you don't want people denied their moment.
And we've had award shows these past couple months. The BET Awards were actually very powerful and impressive. MTV Music Video Awards, or whatever that is these days, I know they existed. But one of the things about those shows is that they have very clearly not been live. And this actually is going to be mostly live, right?
This is going to be overwhelmingly live. There are, I would probably assume that there's going to be a few more pre-taped segments than we would have seen in the past, but those have sort of become part and parcel of award shows anyways. It's all of the other award shows that we've seen have been pre-taped because they're performance-based, and it's really easy to sort of package a bunch of pre-recorded performances because you're still getting that element of surprise. There's absolutely no way to keep the winners of the Emmys a secret if it was already out early. And also, the whole point of the Emmys, like the Oscars, is the actual winning and the acceptance speeches and the awards themselves.
So with so much going on and so much unpredictability, what do you see as the biggest area that could pose a problem that could interrupt the live broadcast?
Oh, I mean, I have no idea what the actual problem could be because I'm not a scientist. And that's the funny thing about, like, talking to these producers about this is they acknowledge that, yes, of course, things could go wrong. We had many technical difficulties of me just trying to call into this podcast today because it's a...
But like there's a wildfire here in Los Angeles that is near Mount Wilson where there are several radio towers last I saw it was within, 500 feet? I mean, what happens if that fire, could that pose a big problem? Is that a risk?
I mean... If that fire knocks down the communications tower that it is quite close to, there are much bigger problems outside of the Emmys. But yes, that's a problem. I mean, we've all learned in the last 6 months, especially relying on our internet connections and video conferencing, that it is just truly unpredictable a lot of the times, and you don't know when you're just gonna have a dropped call. So I don't think that there's obviously specific safeguards that are taken into place and backup signals, and I'm sure a lot of bandwidth accounted for, but it's very unpredictable.
Now, what can you tell us about the packages that were sent to all of these nominations? I saw a couple of people posting pictures on Twitter of the technological pack that everybody was sent.
Oh, yes. It's very, very nice. It's much more expensive than the microphone you sent me to podcast with. It's like a laptop apparatus connected to a really fancy ring light with a camera. I'm sure it's a number K camera. I'm not very up to speed on those details, but it's nice equipment. And it's sterilized, and it is now in celebrity homes across Los Angeles and the world.
So if you had to guess, who is going to be the first winner on Monday night to forget to turn off mute on their Zoom connection when they're giving a speech?
I'm under the impression that people are not in control of their audio. There's going to be a massive this 1984 Apple commercial-esque video village at the Staples Center, and they will be turning people's audio off and on because I don't think anyone's going to trust that. Also, people are going to be drinking and stuff.
Unlike the usual Emmys, when everyone's just kind of trapped in there and there's no alcohol.
I know, and then you have to run to the lobby and get in a 40-minute line just to get a $12 Bud Light. Not that I've done it.
But when you've also got someone in some 1984-esque room controlling audio, what does that mean when there's actual acceptance speeches that are going to be, obviously, I would imagine, be heavy with political and social justice and themes of climate change, all probably being among the topics that the winners are going to talk about? So, in the past, when we've heard the Emmys kind of, turn the music up and play people off, how is that going to be something that's going to work? Are people going to cut away from winners who are delivering impassioned speeches?
They have said no, that there will not be any cutting away because they believe that these sort of spontaneous moments are what's going to make the show interesting.
And yet your interview seemed to suggest that they also think that they can do this on time. And to me, that seems like a real mystery is how they're going to be able to fit in the whole.
Yeah, there's also an argument for it just running under. If people are awkward and the feeds are short, it could very well just be a 2.5-hour show. There's no way to know. Everything is unpredictable. It's incredible.
So if you were to make one prediction for that you would like to see during the show, whether it be something that Kimmel did or one of the pre-tape bits or something from someone at home, what would that be? What do you really want to see, Mikey?
I want to see a bunch of cast members of one show at somebody's house together doing something. I mean, not performing, but I think that it would be exciting to see people together and not just this face in a square box, because even though it's going to be more high def and glossier than the stuff that we've been seeing, it's still a face in a box. So I want depth. I want to see I want to see people interacting at a 6 foot safety distance, obviously. But yeah, that's what I want and sort of expect.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me to see like the cast of something like Schitt's Creek, which obviously ended earlier this year, really get together for one last big night.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about multiple like A-list people hosting events at their home, but I'm not at liberty to discuss it at the time.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Mikey. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me as I connect to you from this rotary phone.
So now we have an idea of what to expect from the show. Moving ahead, there's also, Dan, now the discussion becomes who will win, who should win. We've already gone through three nights of the Creative Arts Awards with The Mandalorian currently atop the leaderboard with 5, followed by RuPaul's Drag Race and Watchmen with 4. HBO leads all networks with 9, followed by Disney Plus, which won its first Emmys. Netflix is currently tied for 4th with 3, and of course the streamer set an Emmy record this year with 160 total nominations. Watchmen at HBO leads all programs with 26. So you've got big wins so far, the creatives with SNL for variety series. But with the big primetime awards coming up, what are you expecting to see? Who do you think is going to win? What's your surprise, Dan? That's like 7 questions in one.
I'm looking forward to this Emmy telecast, not just for all of the unpredictable elements that Mikey just mentioned, but I think that actually is really going to make a big difference this year and is going to keep those of us watching on our toes. But also last year's big winners were Game of Thrones and Fleabag. So those aren't going to win this year. And that means that everything, at least in theory, ought to be fairly wide open. And this is not like the Oscars so much, where there are certain awards in the creative arts categories that are obvious precursors to an outstanding drama or comedy series win. And so you can't go, well, Succession won editing, and therefore that means it's automatically going to win, any more or less than you can look at The Mandalorian winning 5 technical things, including several categories that the Emmys really need to work on, because there's no excuse for it beating like half-hour comedies in certain categories. But I think there are lots of possibilities, and I approve of that. I appreciate that. I like the idea that, yes, I think that Succession is going to win, but, I mean, maybe Disney Plus really played this spectacularly well, and we're all going to be shocked, and The Mandalorian is going to win. That would be ridiculous, but it would also be entertaining and odd, and something's amusing about that. If I had to guess, though, I think that Succession is going to win. On the comedy side, there are some big names there. And so, you know,
Curb Your Enthusiasm, Dead to Me, The Good Place, Insecure, Kominsky Method, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Schitt's Creek, and What We Do in the Shadows are the nominees. I should point
out. And I feel as if Schitt's Creek is going to win. I don't think it probably is the best of those shows, but I think it's the show that's most likely to have a heartfelt and emotional end to its series journey. The Good Place also would, but for whatever reason, there seems to be more widespread emotional connection to Schitt's Creek than to The Good Place, which I think is a better show.
We've heard from a lot of our guests on the show, Dan, people really turn to Schitt's Creek to escape from the real world. So it definitely has that momentum riding for it, too.
Yeah, I think there's no question that benefited Schitt's Creek and probably will have some impact on it probably winning. But then on the other side, in the limited series category, I think there were circumstances in which any one of those 5 nominees, Little Fires Everywhere, Mrs. America, Unbelievable, Unorthodox, and Watchmen, could have gained momentum. But the truth is that Watchmen is the show that we've been talking about for the past 3 months, tied with all of the stuff about criminal justice reform and Black Lives Matter and all of the things that have been at the tip of our tongue for months now. And I would be at this point shocked if Watchmen didn't win. It feels to me like it probably is a prohibitive favorite. And I would say of that group, it probably is the most deserving winner. And then you look at the acting categories, and there are just so many potentially good moments. A lot of them are moments that would have been better if they were actually in person. You know, if Catherine O'Hara wins an Emmy in front of an audience of people who love Catherine O'Hara, that becomes a standing ovation and people cry and it's very emotional and it's great. If Catherine O'Hara wins an Emmy in a nice home wherever she lives, and maybe or maybe not with or without other cast members from the show, it's emotional, but not in the same way. So there's a little minor disappointment of simply the reality of where we are in the world. And so, yeah.
I get that feeling. I mean, you know, that's kind of what I've been thinking about as I watch a lot of baseball. When you see some of these major milestones that these players are achieving, and there's no standing ovation, there's no crowd roar, there's nothing, you know. Albert Pujols just tied Willie Mays on the all-time home run list, and it was forgotten almost immediately. And your heart kind of goes out to those folks, and I kind of wonder about the Emmy, you know, and what's going to happen, you know, like when people can kind of go back again. Is there going to be some other great grand big celebration and big party for Schitt's Creek winning if they win series and Catherine O'Hara wins for her performance? You know, that's what I think about.
So in that same area, you get someone like Helena Bonham Carter, who has been nominated for everything over the years and tends not to win. Well, I mean, if she wins for the crown on Sunday, rather, that would be obviously very emotional, and it would be significant because she is very decorated, but it wouldn't be the same thing. It's kind of like the way that there was the year that the Golden Globes weren't telecast, and that was one of the few acting awards that at that time John Hamm had actually won. And so he had the strange designation of having won a Golden Globe, but not one that anyone saw him win. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing a lot of this, because I think there are many fewer sure thing winners than there have been in some years. So I think there's a chance this could be a really fun and satisfying Emmy night, or alternatively, the choices could all be horrible and everybody's Wi-Fi connections could crap out and it could be just an utter disaster. And, you know, if it's a disaster, that's still interesting, too, because it's not like it's a disaster in a way that the producers are responsible for. If things go pear-shaped, you know, act of God, there's nothing that anyone can do. Best laid plans, all of that. So you can't like blame someone and say, man, they should have known better than whatever. They're trying something. They're trying to do it live. I hope it works. But if it doesn't, it would just be another thing in 2020 that, you know, that went to hell. So even that could be entertaining. I am looking forward to the Emmys on Sunday night. I may have called them Monday in our chat with Mikey. They're really and truly Sunday night.
Yeah. So really quick, Dan, you want to run down your picks? If you're, tell us your Emmy pool picks. So,
oh God, no,
come on.
No. You are confusing me with my navel ganger, Scott Feinberg. He is the one who gives you recommendations that you should actually put money on. You should not put money on anything I say. So.
Well, I'm not saying put money on this. I'm saying you, as someone who consumes an incredible amount of television, who do you want to see win? Let's just go really quickly. Drama series. You said Succession is who you think is going to win. Is that who you're rooting for?
I'm rooting for Succession or Better Call Saul. To me, either one of those two would make me very happy.
And comedy series.
It's a tougher one because a lot of my more favorite comedies, something like Rami, didn't get nominated for comedy series. I'm kind of rooting for What We Do in the Shadows, but figuring it's going to be Schitt's Creek.
Right. And limited series.
It's going to be Watchmen, and it should be Watchmen.
And actor in a drama. Jason Bateman, Sterling K. Brown, Steve Carell, Brian Cox, Billy Porter, and Jeremy Strong.
I think it should be Jeremy Strong. I think it probably will be Brian Cox, and I'm entirely okay with that if that's what it is. He just probably should have been in the supporting category.
And actress in a drama. So Jennifer Aniston, Olivia Colman, Jodie Comer, Laura Linney, Sandra Oh, and Zendaya.
I think it should be Laura Linney, which is interesting for me to say as someone who is not a big Ozark fan. And if I had to guess, God, if it had been earlier in the year, I think it would have been Jennifer Aniston for sure. I would still probably guess Jennifer Aniston. But again, do not put money down based on my predictions.
Right. And comedy actor Anthony Anderson, Don Cheadle, Ted Danson, Michael Douglas, Eugene Levy, and Rami Yosef.
I would like for it to be Rami. And if I had to guess, I think Eugene Levy feels like he's kind of the moment, and he hasn't won an Emmy since back in the SCTV days for writing, so that would be good.
And we'll wrap it up here with comedy actress Christina Applegate, Rachel Brosnahan, Linda Cardellini, Catherine O'Hara, Issa Rae, and Tracy Ellis Ross.
When Scott Feinberg and I did our Should Win, Will Win, I said Linda Cardellini should win, and I would be completely fine with that. I really do think this one is Catherine O'Hara's to lose, though, and I think if it actually were Emmy night and she won, I think there would have been a standing ovation. It would have been emotional. It would have been great because she, you know, she's a national treasure. And even if that nation is somewhat Canada, I think she is going to have her moment, even if it's a really, really strange moment via Zoom or something.
Well, there you have it. There's Dan's picks. Thank you to Mikey for joining us for this segment. And yeah, Emmys are Sunday on ABC.
Number two.
Up second, we have another surprising renewal reversal as a result of, or at least partially the result of, the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. ABC's Stumptown, which was a borderline renewal in the spring, but still did get a second season, is unfortunately the latest scripted series to be canceled as a result of all of the stuff happening in the world. So, Leslie, break down what you have been able to find out about why ABC decided to pull the plug on Stumptown and if there are any hopes for it finding another home.
Well, it's really interesting and surprising on this front to me because this is a show that ABC owned in-house, meaning it was beneficial for them to keep the show going because they stood to profit the most. They didn't have to pay another company licensing fees, for example. But what I'm hearing is this was an issue of scheduling. So while other shows that have been scrapped, including USA Network's Evel Knievel miniseries, were dropped because of scheduling issues related to the actors and showrunners, Milo, of course, had the new season of This Is Us to film and the window to produce that show closed. This is actually more of ABC's scheduling and when they wanted the show on the network. They wanted it to premiere in the fall. ABC has just announced its return dates for its scripted dramas for November, where you've got Grey's Anatomy and Station 19, the new David E. Kelly show. All of those shows are going to return staggered dates in November. And Stumptown wasn't going to be ready for November. And paired with the fact that the show was an expensive one to produce because you've got a cast and star in Kobe Smulders, who is not inexpensive. Jake Johnson, I'm sure, you know, came with a price tag. It filmed a lot on location. Production on it hadn't yet started. There was also a creative reboot. There's a new showrunner that was that came in. I'm told that while Carrie Burke liked what she saw of the new scripts for season two, other executives may not have agreed. So it was a combination of factors. They wanted it for fall, wasn't going to be ready. It's too expensive of a show to hold for later of the year. The soonest, if they started production like ASAP now, when you've got great shows like Grey's Anatomy that have already been rolling for a couple of weeks now, the soonest they could get it back on the air is April. Now you're getting into the spring and the summer months where hopefully maybe you're going to see people be able to go outside again and really enjoy the summer that nobody got this year. So viewing habits traditionally decline during those periods of time. So yeah, it's too expensive to hold. Creative wasn't there and it just wasn't going to work. So ABC just replaced it on the Wednesday at 10 p.m. Slot with For Life. So, and as if the show is going to get renewed for another season somewhere else, I don't know. You know, right now, everyone, as we've talked about on the show for months, is focused on owning their content. So you'd have to look at the rest of Disney's platforms. Does it really work at Disney Plus? Does it work at Hulu? Does it work at Freeform? And the answer probably across the board is going to be no. You know, when you look at Hulu, you know, it doesn't really work there. Also, why would you go through the issue of canceling a show if you're going to set it up at another one of your own in-house platforms? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think there's no obviously Freeform was not going to be the solution for where that show was supposed to go. And I don't think that there's any way that Disney Plus was going to be. It doesn't fit with any of the brands that they've established. It probably is a more adult show than what they go for. And if they were to take it to somewhere, I assume the producers would rather go someplace where they could actually push the content into a cable space as opposed to a child-friendly Disney Plus space. And the thing with Hulu is, I mean, Hulu knows what the numbers for that show are, and ABC knows what the numbers for that show are on Hulu. So if this was a show that had had a massive Hulu audience, well, they wouldn't have done this whole process of canceling it and not sending it there in the first place. If it were a huge Hulu show, they just would have said it's going to Hulu. That, you know, there wouldn't have been a question. So it clearly isn't that. Not that we have any idea of what its Hulu numbers actually are, but they're obviously not enough that that was going to be the thing that was going to save it. So
right. And to your point, Dan, you know, we saw remember Seth MacFarlane's show The Orville aired originally on Fox. They renewed it. And then when production was pushed, this is pre-pandemic, and it wasn't going to be ready for when Fox wanted it, Fox went back to 20th Century Fox, which is owned now by Disney, and said, hey, this doesn't work for us anymore. And Disney sat there and said, well, we're going to take it straight to Hulu. And now it's a Hulu original because Hulu found great success with a lot of Seth MacFarlane's other shows, including all the animated stuff. So it was one fell swoop, right? Gone at Fox, set up at Hulu, one story, boom, here it is. That's not the case here. So it's really surprising to me. And of course, this is the latest show to really have it to be unrenewed, as we've started to say here. True TV's I'm Sorry, Evil at USA, Netflix's The Society, and I Am Not Okay With This. And I'm sure there's likely to be more. And on the development front, it's happening behind the scenes, too. There's a great thread from a brilliant writer named Javier Grillo-Marxwatch, who wrote this week about a script that he'd been working on and developing for a few years now that had been bounced around from different platforms that just got a pass because it was a big scope, big budget show, and now they were unable to find a new home for it. So that's happening a lot more than I think anyone really expects.
The part that confuses me is the idea that things are going to look like they're cast-offs if they premiere in March or April of next year, whereas my sense is that I'm not really sure anybody knows, A, what a production timetable looks like in general at this point, B, what the prospects are that come November or December, they aren't going to have to completely shut down again for multiple months. So to me, having a show that's developing scripts, if it's true that some of the brass at ABC liked it, it seems to me like next March is going to be as good a time as any to have a new scripted original show that you know has some audience and some level of critical warmth, though I'm not saying that, you know, Stumptown was going to get resurrected because a half dozen of the critics you follow on Twitter really like it. But to me, I think that what this is going to do, all of the juggled production and the new timetables and all of that, it's going to push more and more for there to be more original programming the rest of the year around, because just no one is working on the same schedule that they were working on 2 years ago at this time. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. To that point, Dan, it's these networks are still holding on to this archaic fall season, you know, and yes, you know, this is something that has been around for decades, and it was generally pitched and created to go around with when kids are going back to school, when new cars go on sale, and advertisers used to buy commercial time on TV to help sell them. It, you know, we've written stories for years now about how broadcast networks are shifting to year-round originals, but what we haven't seen is high-end scripted, premium scripted, on broadcast that is prioritized all year because, you know, look, people lay down in December because it's the holidays and folks aren't watching TV as much, or at least they, you know, in a normal pre-pandemic world, they're not. Same in the summers. The summer, as I mentioned, is traditionally lower in terms of total homes utilizing television. Hut levels are always lower. So you're seeing a lot of inexpensive shows during those periods, or a lot of like event movie stuff, you know, like Freeform always does their big Christmas movies and a lot of that stuff. And a lot of it is an original, right? It's all licensed fare. So, or you see a ton of unscripted shows in the summer. And if you remember a few years ago, CBS did this big brand new model with a show called Under the Dome. And they said, we're going to make big, expensive, high-end shows and we're going to put them on in the summer. And the way that they did it was they sold streaming rights to Netflix to help finance and offset the cost of producing an expensive show in a period of time when people don't watch TV. It worked for a few years, and then, oh, guess what? People didn't want to license their content to Netflix anymore because now they have their own streaming platform. So it's just like one giant mess. So it's very curious what happened with Stumptown. To me, there's still another piece that doesn't quite add up here, but Only time will tell if we ever find out what that is.
Yeah, I feel like we really have learned in the past 7 months that having pieces of original content on the shelf that you can plug in is rarely a bad thing. It's not a disaster. And so there have to have been other pieces to this other than just it was going to be delayed until spring. But I certainly don't know what they are, but you, I'm sure, will at some point get to the bottom of it.
I hope. And, you know, we should also mention that ABC this week also handed out a straight to series order for Rebel, the Erin Brockovich inspired drama from Grey's Anatomy showrunner Krista Vernoff. Fun fact here, she said on Twitter that she wrote her first pilot 17 years ago and has written 13 more in the interim and only 5 of them actually filmed. This is her first series order to come from that. So she'll now have 3 shows on ABC's schedule, including Grey's and the spinoff Station 19. And if you want to look at it from a scheduling point of view and a giant puzzle to piece together, For Life moves up to fall and replaces Stumptown. So now you need something to replace For Life on the schedule for later in the year. And here it is in Rebel.
Up third.
Number 3.
We've talked for the past month and a half about the changes happening as part of NBC Universal's executive restructuring. Last week, we talked in a great amount of depth about not just the shuffling, but about the carousel or musical chairs aspect of it. And so this week we got a little bit more musical chairs aspect, including the company losing a key creative executive of several decades. Leslie, break it down for the kids.
Chris McCumber, who has been with NBC Universal for nearly 2 decades, has stepped down as president of USA Network and Sci-Fi. He will not be replaced. Instead, incoming exec Susan Rovner, who we mentioned on last week's show, will absorb his duties as NBC Universal consolidates oversight of entertainment content under Rovner and on the business side under Berwick. So to me, you know, this is not unexpected when you look at the new structure that is taking shape at the company, but it's also a big surprise because McCumber was a valued exec. He led USA to become the number one cable network for a TV record 14 straight years. I just want to stress that again, 14 straight years as number one, a record that is not likely to ever be matched. So he also is fresh off of retooling Sci-Fi, which I'm told had its most profitable year last year. You know, it's a big surprise when you lose a good executive. He will land somewhere great. This is not anywhere near why Paul Telegdy was pushed out at NBC. Kind of same idea in terms of absorbing structure and a portfolio under one exec. But this is a respected executive who made the decision to step down. I'm told they tried to find a place in the new structure to put him, but he was ready to move on. And obviously, it was going to lose a lot of his purview considering Rovner's new role. But yeah, it's a big loss for those two big important cable brands.
And I guess the alternative approach to it would be that while, as you say, McCumber had a fantastic run and there were all of those years where he established the Blue Sky brand of USA and all of those
white
shows
collar psych. Yeah.
Burn Notice. Why do people always forget Burn Notice? But so all of those successful shows that had audiences that loved them, that were all part of a completely different era for USA. There is no trace of that era on USA at this point. So,
right. But that was a while ago too. And he also led the reinvention of USA into more darker and edgier prestige fare when he greenlit Mr. Robot. He is the one who signed Sam Esmail, who created Mr. Robot, to a big overall deal. He is now one of NBC Universal's most important showrunner deals. He's doing Battlestar Galactica for Peacock. He is an important producer in that portfolio. And McCumber and his head of scripted, Bill McGoldrick, who is now doing scripted for cable and Peacock, they're responsible for Mr. Robot. And, you know, leading a brand, a successful brand like USA from the Blue Skies one into more of this dark and edgy fare with Mr. Robot. And then you saw it with The Sinner, which is an anthology, and a couple other shows that he did that have now, you know, gone by the wayside. That's a big loss. I keep saying it because it's big.
It is absolutely. Anytime anyone has been at a job that big for as long as he was, it's significant. My own feeling on this from the outside is that USA was in the continued process of figuring out what it was again. I mean, Mr. Robot was supposed to mark a shift for the network that didn't really shift. It was supposed to be the thing that said, okay, we're now big time Emmy players. We're now kind of a little bit less like what we were before with Burn Notice and a little bit more, maybe God forbid, like HBO. And I don't know that that is what actually emerged from that, because Mr. Robot was not the breakout popular hit that it could have been after its first year. It wasn't as big an awards player as it could have been. There were all of those things and changes that Mr. Robot was supposed to bring about for USA that it really didn't. And then we've talked several times about how sci-fi seems to be constantly shedding its skin and becoming different things, and that every couple months it seems like they're going with a different, if not brand identity, they're going with a different marketing slogan, and they're going with a different show that's supposed to be whatever their next big show is supposed to be, whether it's something like Happy or Krypton or something like that. They keep having these shows that are all supposed to be the shows that they can build the new brand around, and yet none of them keep being that. So maybe,
but they, here's the thing though, they are. The problem is that they're too expensive, because you green light, and and the same is true for USA Network, right? You loved, what was the show? Dare Me was a show that you loved, right, Dan? And they canceled it after one season. Well, they pre-sold streaming rights to Netflix. There's no money left on the table for them. So if they don't have, if they're not going to make money on streaming, or if they can't supply it to their own platform, it's just, you know, you're burning money, because there's no live audience anymore. No one watches on linear. Most of the people who find shows now today all think they're Netflix originals. You know, it's hard if you're a basic cable. And that's why you've seen a big retreat in the volume of scripted originals, not just at USA and sci-fi, but across the board. And I think that's a big reason why NBC Universal is restructuring. And you're going to start to see a lot of their shows debut on multiple platforms, right? They just announced that the Joe Exotic show starring Kate McKinnon is going to air on not only Peacock, but NBC and USA as well in some fashion or another. I'm sure it's going to be maybe a multi-platform launch across all three, but that's obviously to be determined. But that's going to be the new strategy going forward at NBC Universal, and why you're seeing execs like McCumber go. So, and why it's exciting for someone like Rovner to come in.
And now I'm sad and disappointed that we're not going to get a second season of Dare Me. Y'all missed the boat on that one, people.
But hey, it's on Netflix, so you still have time to hop on the boat. So
yeah, but you just won't get closure. So whatever makes you happy.
Spoiler alert, Dan. Well, let's go from that depressing story into something fun. Up next is our showrunner spotlight segment.
Number four.
Our guests this week are Anna Conkle and Maya Erskine, co-creators, co-showrunners, and co-stars of Hulu's Pen 15, Hulu's Penis. The first season premiered in 2019, and it earned Erskine and Conkle an Emmy nomination, a pair of Writers Guild nominations, and more. The 7-episode second season premieres on Hulu on September 18th. Welcome to the podcast, Anna and Maya.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to start with the original pitch for this show. I heard that you guys filmed a short 15-minute pilot presentation to help sell it. My question is, do you think that this show would have gotten made had you not come armed with footage of the concept, considering it involved women in their early 30s playing 13-year-olds and was titled Penis?
Yeah, I definitely don't think it would have been made. It's a miracle that it already was accepted even after having made a pilot presentation. We pitched to, I think, 4 or 5 places only. And I think we really lucked out that Hulu was into it. It was such an experiment to have adults play middle schoolers against other middle schoolers and show it in an R-rated, kind of uncensored way. That was how we would describe it, that, you know, we wanted to show middle school as it really happened, which was, you know, there were things going on that we don't like to talk about. And you were seeing uncomfortable ways of bodies growing that no one wanted to see. But obviously, we didn't want to have kid actors be doing those things necessarily. So we thought it was best to have adults, ourselves, play that, because there could be enough distance, at least, for the viewer to watch safely. But yeah, it was a total experiment, and we even had no idea that would work when we made the presentation.
If you don't mind me asking, where else did you take it, and who passed?
We took it to Showtime, to HBO, Where else, Anna? There was one other place.
It was just three. It was just Hulu, HBO, right. Showtime.
Yeah. Wow.
And yeah. HBO and Showtime were just straight no's?
Yeah.
Wow.
Hard no's. Yeah, when we first shot that 15-minute short, and it was half a pilot, it was a little bit more leaning in the sketch direction, even though we were really trying to not do that. And we were also, I think, in our mid-20s. Like, when we first started working on this, the log line was two actors in their mid-20s, and then that changed over all the years of it not being made. And people being like, "This, you can't make this. This is illegal." So, yeah, we had to roll with that.
Yeah, the Showtime pitch was maybe the worst one, just because we were pitching to two executives that had, one of them had a kid that was 13 at the time, and I chose to hold up a picture of me at 13 holding my dad, you know, in an embrace and smiling next to him. And I was like holding it up close to his face and saying, you know, right before this picture was taken, I had masturbated. And I was using that as an example to share, you know, the juxtaposition of like that age of going through sexual, you know, exploration and masturbating, but then also wanting to remain a little girl in your parents' eyes. And so, but that, he was like, "Can you please take down that picture? Because I'm really uncomfortable." Like, and so that's when we knew the pitch was done.
He said, "I'm really nauseous.
I'm nauseous, right? This is making me nauseous."
Was that Gary Levine or David Nevins? You don't have to answer that. I'm just dying to know.
No taken. Yeah. Yeah. She might have had it like out, like, you know, as close to his face. You've never done anything like that where like you just hold a picture, but for some reason you were like, well, I guess he was far enough away.
I think because I wasn't getting the laughs. And so I just thought, well, just keep holding it up, you know, like maybe it'll click in for him or he'll connect. And he never did. And then I realized I was holding the picture up too long. But yeah.
Well, now, okay. So the first season, a lot of the time from the viewer perspective is spent kind of adjusting your eyes and your brain to the two of you guys in those characters. And with this new episode, these new episodes, I was really struck by how instantly and almost matter of factly it's like, okay, they're just part of this world now. Was there a similar instant comfort writing and performing the second season for you guys?
I felt it in the performing, because a little bit of my self-consciousness of being like, I'm an adult going to try to honestly play a 13-year-old. This could be hugely humiliating, which it is. But also it, you know, I just got over myself a little bit where I was like, yeah, whatever. I'm going to just go for it. And what happens, happens. So that was nice getting to settle into it. We knew more of what the show was. Writing-wise, it was scarier, I thought, because we had gone into season one like, this is an experiment. We were so the underdogs. You know, most people were pretty honest about not getting the show. I don't know how it was made. Really, all the assistants loving it, enough of them, honestly. And so it was just this feeling of like, uphill in a good way, in an inspiring way, that was that we get to make this thing and we love it and maybe no one will like it, but we're going to make it to the best of our ability. And then there was this amazing thing that happened where people actually liked it and were watching it. And that was a great feeling. But then going into the second season, I was like, I don't know how to be not an underdog. You know, I don't know how to do this. Like, yeah, we did a great thing. Let's do it again. You know, that's not my mantra for myself. So we kind of went back to sticking with the old mantra of, you know, we just got to love it. We can't be afraid of failing, you know, and obviously we are, but you just kind of fight through that and let's just keep doing this for us.
Yeah, season one, we sort of approached it like, we're not going to get the chance to do this again. This may be our only chance. So we kind of put so much into season one, so many of our stories, so many of our firsts and traumatic experiences, that of course there was that fear entering second season. Oh my God, do we not have enough material? Do we not have stories? Is there no more to tell? But we lucked out because we also have had an amazing writer's room and more experiences to mine from. And also it was kind of a revelation of like, oh, it doesn't have to be these big firsts. There are so many small moments that happen at that age or through that time that can be a prompt for a story or be a prompt for this whole season arc. You know, that was a good challenge for us to think of it that way.
Well, so much of the show kind of hinges on the discomfort that the audience feels and the discomfort that we can kind of see in you guys as well. When you lose some of that, when the audience is maybe actually, God forbid, comfortable with you guys, do you have to look for discomfort elsewhere to kind of get that anxiety in the viewers or in the room?
That's so interesting. I don't think that I think of it like that. I don't know if you do, Maya, but it kind of just innately... Well, first of all, it was a surprise to me, but it shouldn't have been that so many people first season were like, I had to turn it off because it was too uncomfortable, you know? And I know not everyone feeling that way. Obviously, I'm not hearing from all of them. So I know it's a lot more. To me, you know, it's just real. In reality, there are cringy moments that are hard for me to watch. Usually, like my first kiss first season, that was... I can't watch that, even though that's me and my boyfriend, which is actually probably why I can't watch it, because I'm like, we still have to have sexual chemistry. Your tongue is so in the wrong place. But I think the challenge this year was, you know, we've been working on this project for so long. So just how do we keep liking playing these characters? We're 33 now. We want them to grow. We want them to mature. We want to have content that we're excited by as actors and writers, you know? So that is kind of more the thing, but that's so interesting.
You know, season two was expanded to 14 episodes and then split in half. I wonder how much of that split season was because of the pandemic and filming interruption.
It actually had nothing to do with it. Originally it was kind of conceived like two seasons creatively, but it was 2A and then called 2B. But so we lucked out actually that we got to finish all, since we block shoot, we finished all the first seven episodes. And our third co-creator, Sam Zwiebelman, who directed all of them, he went off and started editing those for the first director's cuts while we continued with the second half, 2B. But then quarantine hit right when we had, I think it was like 2 weeks left. So we have like four scenes or so. I mean, I would say several scenes from four episodes left to do.
Yeah. And we just kind of approached both seven arcs as two separate story arcs. And it was supposed to come out the second arc 6 months after the first one. But now that's going to be more like a year. So, and we were just talking about it. I'm really excited about that next, which I don't have. I'm always so scared, and who knows, maybe everyone will hate them, but I'm excited about those.
Well, we had so much fun making them. I think it felt like a nice, cause the first part of filming was, we were kind of plagued by a lot of, natural disasters, personal disasters. There were things that kept halting or threatening to halt production, but we'd be working around it. And then so once we got to the final seven episodes, Anna and I got to sort of relax into it a bit more and have more fun with it. But creatively, yeah, it's an exciting season, I think, that Anna and Maya evolve a bit more and turn more into teenagers, I would say.
So 2A is kind of its own contained arc, and then 2B is kind of almost the third season, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, creatively.
So almost like two finales for the price of one.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
It's a great way of saying it.
I feel like in these early episodes, you guys are definitely trying to push the structure and the format a little bit. I think the third episode in particular feels like a very large deviation in tone and to some degree genre. How big a risk did that episode feel to you guys? And how confident were you that you could pull off the kind of mixture of humor and almost horror that that episode has?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I feel like we always knew that we didn't, in theory, we didn't want to be afraid of the episodes and seasons changing in the sense of content, of it being like, you know, I remember in one of our first Q&As for first season, someone asked, you know, some really dark shit happens at that age. Is there anything you wouldn't tell? And I was like, no, I think we tell everything. And then I thought, well, actually, no, not everything. And this maybe was somewhere in the middle where the intention always was to go here at some point, but it want, you know, we wanted it to be motivated and make sense for the story. So, and then, you know, kind of melding that episode of your parents' dysfunctions, you know, and your own family, which so many of us can relate to, I think, I hope, and yes, your own trauma and secrets, you know, being violent sometimes in a way, whether literally or emotionally. And at 13, I think it's very funny and also very sad, which is our favorite combination, to mix out with witchcraft of like, I'm going to control this. You know, I'm going to use my powers, Shillelagh Pompano, and I'm going to control the situation and fix this. And it's so naive and sad and heartbreaking, also funny. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, we were so excited. I think it started really talking about when we were that age, like our different experiences of playing with witchcraft or starting to, you know, believe that we had powers or that our friends had powers, and how easy it was to get swept up in that. Like, I had a friend who would be like, a leprechaun just came. Maya, close your eyes. A leprechaun just came and took these three rubber bands away. I'm like, no, no, he didn't. I swear to God, a leprechaun is here. And you got to believe in that and have fun with that. And so I think with that, you know, Anna, you just said it all, so I'm just repeating you really, but like the excitement of having a frame of these girls who at the start of the season are trying to escape their own identities by like jumping into these different identities, and one of them happens to be Wiccan, you know, it worked so well, I think, and Anna did such a beautiful job of writing this, of melding with the story of trying to escape her parents and the home life and escape that reality and control it with, you know, witchcraft. That is always what we're looking for, of like finding two things, one light, one dark, and how they can come together. 'Cause that's sort of life.
Yeah. And And both my parents thankfully were supportive of it. Although my mom keeps going, it's fine, I'm going to have to move out of the universe. I'll just get an apartment outside of the universe.
Did she say that?
That's like her, that's her line right now. But then she'll say, no, no, I'm really proud of you.
Aww.
You know, that's, you got to share it in your art, you know, and I'm so lucky that's the mentality, you know?
Well, with the show like this, there's always going to be the assumption that the show is largely or possibly entirely autobiographical. When you compare the first and the second seasons, how much have on screen Anna and Maya become standalone characters who aren't really you guys? And how much are they still really you guys?
I don't know. The line is kind of blurry, but I do feel like it's kind of 50-50, because there is, like, even if we don't have a story that is exactly how it happened to us, you know, like the sleepover is an example where Maya's pad flies out. That's something similar to that happened to me, but that's not how it went down. It happened during
a
play.
Let's hear about that.
Well, yeah, it happened during a play, really, but
crazy.
Right. But then there's the, so sometimes our real life inspires, you know, these storylines or these moments that can then we build an episode around. So in that sense, I feel like we'll have these autobiographical moments, the true feelings that come up or that are triggered when we're doing any emotional scene or any scene that is traumatic, can feel autobiographical, but I do feel like Maya and Anna have become their own characters in a way that exist in this world that is a forever limbo, you know, seventh grade forever. And Maya and Anna, us, you know, we weren't friends in real life at this time. So we always talk about it as like, we are rewriting our histories in a way. And sometimes we're like changing little things that we wish happened or that help the story more or, you know, so I don't know if 50-50 is a good answer, but
yeah, that I agree with you. It feels so slippery. Like I can't, Because I think it's just weird writing something based on yourself, first of all, and then going back and trying to emulate that at 13, but then innately, you know, you can't do it exactly. So then it becomes this character. And what is memory? And anyway, I'm going to get into like a weird zone, but it really is hard to tell. I mean, if I broke down all the moments in all of the scripts, I feel like so many moments we could relate to as though, you know, as though it really happened. And so often when we're outlining, Maya and I would like, you know, really just be relaying conversations that we had then, or as we would imagine them to have organically have between ourselves or our characters. But then there's so much that didn't happen. So yeah, that's a horrible answer, but that's truly how it feels in my head. It's so hard to say.
It's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, at the same time, you know, without spoiling too much, you know, Anna's parents' divorce is a big part of season two and a storyline that will hit home for a lot of viewers, myself included. My parents split in the 90s when I was in high school. But how much of that was pulled from your experience?
That's pretty straight on, dead on. That's straight on, as they say. No, I'm just kidding. They divorced when they told me when I was 14, so eighth grade. And then they split the house up for 2 years. And that was a whole thing that, you know, we did want to go more into, and but there's way too many storylines to juggle. But I thought, you know, that came through. And yeah, they're such the actors in the show do such an amazing job with them. And my parents in real life are even more eccentric and gregarious. And, you know, it was a wild, it was kind of a wild household. So that episode was a really scary, liberating one to just show that feeling. I remember that feeling so well of, you know, watching a TV show with my friend and starting to hear the voices of their fight getting louder and just like really subtly trying to turn the volume up like it was no big deal. And, you know, most of the time we never talked about it. And it was like, I love in the scene when Maya's like, no, I can't hear anything because I love this episode. But to get to rewrite that, you know, the spying that I would do by myself usually and then feel sad and alone, I got to do with my best friend, very meta and trippy to do it in real life with my best friend and then rewrite that story to be like whisked into the woods and to actually have fun. And then also the end to like be dealing, trying to deal with and talk about mental health. And, you know, that was the first time in my life where I started to feel what I understand now as depression. But at the time it was like, this is just, I just want to get out of here. Like, I can't deal with this pain. So to get to like have Maya go through that with me, you know, it's always feels so vulnerable to do those kinds of scenes in front of the whole crew. You know, we don't get to just write it and be like, hey, go act it. Bye. This isn't really me, you know, to write it and be like, everybody that I respect and love, like everyone watch my pain, and judge me. But anyway, to get to do that with Maya and literally be held by Maya being like, I need you. I love you. I'm here for you. I mean, how incredible.
I feel so grateful that you shared this story for this season, because Anna, I don't know if I can say, but she had originally written a play about this that was amazing. And it was about her parents, because I had never heard, you know, I understood what divorce meant on some intellectual level, but her story was so specific in that after the divorce, they lived together in the house. That is such, you know, a specific, intense experience that we all felt so grateful that she shared it for Pen 15.
Thanks, Maya. It's so mutual. The things that, you know, we're both willing to share is pretty cool.
Do the kids in the cast, do they understand how much you guys are putting yourself out there emotionally in this? Like, do they have any way of processing how cathartic this could be for you, given that they're 13 or 14 themselves?
Mm.
I feel like the posh episode was the one, because usually the traumatic moments are more private.
Right.
You know, where it's just me and Maya or Maya and parents or me and parents or something. But the one, the posh episode in season one, you really saw after we did the Spice Girls dance and the racism, you really saw everyone kind of be like, oh, when I read this scene, I thought this was funny and this feels really icky and bad now that we right. just did it.
Well, the girls thought, yeah, it was such a, we were even surprised by how it hit us emotionally because I think everyone was super excited. It was the first day we were getting all the kids that we were going to be acting alongside the kids. And so everyone was in their Spice Girl outfit and were dancing and it was very funny and fun and the whole crew was watching. I feel like this was the first day they kind of got excited by the show because at first they were like, what the fuck is this? This is really wild. Like, I've never seen, why is this adult masturbating with a pony? And so anyway, after, so everyone was really excited and watching it. And then I, in the middle of the scene, like they were saying the Guido stuff and we cut and I had my family visiting. I had my like young nieces and they were like, why are the girls being mean to you? And I, as she's, they were also, they're, you know, a quarter Japanese and I was explaining to them and I just broke down. And so the young actresses were horrified because they were like, oh my God, I hope what I was saying wasn't mean. I don't understand. And Anna had to explain to them, no, it's because you guys are acting like this is just bringing up these emotions. And then it sort of just hit the whole crew. Anna started crying. The whole, you know, crew started crying. It was because everyone started going back into their own memories of either being on one side or the other. And it was just, I think that was the first time we realized how affecting this show can be on us, like how cathartic it is, how triggering it is. But yeah, that was sort of the only moment I think where the kids were like, sorry, I thought this was a comedy. I didn't know that this was gonna result in that.
Yeah. Yeah, or every once in a while, Sammy, who plays Becca, will be like, just remind us, like, actually, in school, I'm actually in the anti-bullying club. So right. I want you to know I would never do that. And she'd be like, I'm so sorry after the scene. So sweet.
Yeah, because she had to call me ugliest girl in school. And she's like, I don't think that. I'm like, it's okay. I don't think it's that. Okay.
It's like hope for the future, right? When you hear stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, now we are talking about the kids, but, you know, how has the dynamic changed between seasons one and two? And, you know, the other part is, too, you know, how much do you feel with the idea of these doing two seasons almost back to back and, you know, the two, you know, 2A and 2B, was that done in a way to kind of help film these episodes before the kids really went through puberty and aged up? I mean, I know Stranger Things, Netflix has done the same thing with that cast with the similar hopes.
Yeah, that was a part of it. No, go, Anna.
Yeah, that was a part of it. I was going to say the same. You nailed it.
Let's just say it at the same
you
time.
You nailed it. Yeah. That was a part of it. Yeah. And then, but now we're screwed because the pandemic. So we have like 10 scenes over, I don't know, seven episodes that it's just Becca's going to look like 21 and then she's going to be back to 13, then 13, 13. And then like,
because the biggest one is a bat mitzvah episode. Becca has a bat mitzvah and we still have a lot of scenes left for that, but we filmed her singing her Haftorah portion and we haven't filmed the big party. So from like the moment before, she'll literally change into a woman before our eyes, which actually kind of works, you know? I mean, there's something
genius,
I didn't even think about that. Okay, I'm happy now. I'm happy. This is going to work great.
Wait, can we delete this so we can, the intention can be that that was the intention?
That was always the intention.
We're like, we wanted to wait.
We wanted to wait till
she
really looked like a woman because it happens when you go through that experience, right?
Yeah, another metaphor. We're always thinking ahead.
How do the kids react to you at this point? Like, do you ever get the sense that they're losing track of you being basically their bosses and 30 something or do they always treat you like you're on a pedestal?
No,
Maya's
not a pedestal.
Maya's best friends with Dylan, who plays Gabe. Like I was gone for maybe 2 weeks Well, in the beginning of shooting, and I got back, and Maya has never been more 13, and Dylan had aged up, and Maya had aged down, and I have this amazing video. Sure, okay. And I have this amazing video of, I think you were pouring pepper, Gabe. Was Dylan or you were pouring pepper? Dylan was pouring pepper on the table and saying, guess which
pepper I'm thinking of.
Yeah, which like a grain of pepper I'm thinking of out of these hundreds.
And I kept being like,
and she was in. They would just do that for hours.
I was like, this is fucking stupid. What are you talking? Okay, fine. Is it this one? Is it this one? And I'd guess it by like the third guess, and I was like, okay, my turn. I love this game. Yeah, when you're playing that age, and also because Anna wasn't there, you know, I had to adapt because, you know, and I was in so many scenes with Dylan, and we just bonded hard.
He's very funny.
But yeah, they definitely first season were, I mean, the girls were into Anna right away because she was out of costume when they met her. But when they met me, I was in costume and the wig. So they were definitely terrified of me and thought I was weird. And then as soon as the season went on, I think they realized we were also women, not just these freaks.
Freak children,
adults. And now they accept us, I would say, right? Like accept?
Yeah. And I like to think they forget a lot that we're older.
Yes.
I think.
I forget that I'm older.
I forget all the
time.
When
I'm with them, I just talk to them like we're peers. I mean, that really is what it is.
Same, which could be really annoying.
Yeah, that's a good point. They probably hate us.
Maybe.
Maybe they hate us. I'm pretty sure they have like group chats that we're totally unaware of, especially any of the boys. I'm totally scared to know what their opinion is of us. That's
how many times they probably texted each other that like Anna's granny panties are out of her pants again or something. But what I want to tell them is that was intentional. Like I asked for the pink underwear. I asked for it to be that large and I wanted it above my
face. Right. Or like the fake nipples we put in our chests.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, pure humiliation.
I feel bad going from something so funny to something so serious, but you know, with these episodes left to film, or these, you know, the multiple scenes left to film and hopefully a third season, have you given any thought to how production on the show will change as you look to shoot during COVID?
Yeah, I think the goal is we just have no idea what the future is, but in an ideal world, we'd be waiting until, you know, there's a vaccine and things were much, much safer. But, you know, no one knows the future, obviously, of what this is going to look like. But Maya and I have been really clear that, you know, on the intention that we, you know, because every place is exploring alternative ways of shooting. And, you know, at one point, I think it was brought up, can we do a green screen? And, you know, we'll have extras there at the party, at the bat mitzvah, and maybe we can do it outside and blah, blah, blah. But we just kept coming back to, if we have to do a green screen and we wouldn't feel comfortable being there, then we don't want anybody to be there. So we're just kind of taking it one day at a time. Fortunately, we only have 2 weeks left to shoot. And after that, I don't know, it's a little incomprehensible.
Yeah, I think it's tough because there were, you know, many conversations. Can you rewrite this scene? Can you rewrite this episode? But because we block shot everything, it's like we didn't want to rewrite the big bat mitzvah episode that you don't ever get to see the party because that's sort of the fun of it, you know, or any of those things. So we kind of were happy to wait until things get figured out more and you know, hopefully, I don't know. Hopefully it goes away.
Yeah. You know, you just don't know what everyone is dealing with health-wise, you know, and that freaks me out. Being in a place of any sort of leadership and being like, we're going back in, guys. Like, I'm too scared.
Right. But you have several unscripted shows, for example, that are kind of doing the quarantine, right? Where they get right. Kind of like what the NBA is doing, right? Where everyone's in a bubble, nobody goes. And if you can block shoot, maybe you can get through that a little bit faster. But, you know, to me that it almost sounds like who knows what the future of the show is beyond what you've already filmed, considering it's going to be so challenging to shoot. And we're starting to see shows get canceled now. because of the variables, including how the logistics of filming during all of this is. And you guys are a show that it's important to build, to shoot with crowds and kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the element of shooting with literally Maya's mother, you know, when, and those things that puts everything to perspective even more so, where we're like, we're literally shooting with your family. And then everyone's going home to their own families and no one has perfected this yet. And I think we just were clear on that. We didn't want to be the guinea pig production, but I don't know what it's going to look like. I mean, we're so lucky that we've shot most of 14 episodes, you know, and we can figure out a creative way to do this. The plan right now is to resume shooting in about, I don't know, 9 months or something like that. And hopefully we'll have another season out in a year. So, you know, if we can stay on that track, it's going to feel pretty, hopefully it'll feel pretty seamless. And if not, then we're probably going to have to do some rewrites and get more creative.
Well, you guys have always had to be kind of light on your feet in terms of production logistics, simply because some things you can't shoot with the kids. And so you've had to kind of find workarounds. I'm curious, in the second season, what are the rules regarding when you actually can shoot with a kid? I mean, Anna, you mentioned that in the first kiss scene, you're making out with your boyfriend, not with an actual child. Probably,
right?
probably just as well. But what are the rules? Like, are there things you choose not to actually say in front of the kids as well? Or is it just actions? How do you play that?
When there's, you know, like the Posh episode, for example, season one, we keep going back to it, but we had conversations with them before, you know, the content that is, you know, possibly going to be a first for them to hear about, though that always feels a little bit naive these days, especially. We try to have conversations with them, their parents. And then, you know, we did find a line in season 2B that's coming up that we were like, okay, this, we're not doing this with kids anymore. We're going to cast 2 adults, because it's so important to us that this material be explicit, because this is how it really happened. But there's nothing funny anymore or comfortable or shooting with doubles or whatever that still feels appropriate, interesting, non-distracting. And otherwise, and Maya, please correct me where I'm wrong here, but we kind of discuss, envision every moment and are really just tried to be as thoughtful as possible with, when we use doubles and stuff. And like when we're shooting, you know, like porn, bad example, but that's never obviously porn, you know, I don't know.
Right.
And stuff like that. I mean, that's all TV. So
in season 2B, we have an even younger actor who is going to be joining the cast, this girl. And so, anytime there were any mature content, mature conversations, we would shoot separately so that she wouldn't be privy to what we were saying or talking about. If we had to have like a huge fight where I say, pretty dark things to her, you know, we would just have extensive conversations with the child actors and their parents. And just like Anna said, like in first season, even a scene where like Sam and I are listening to music in band class and have to look at each other in a loving way, that had to be a big conversation before, because it was sort of like, okay, this is acting. And, you know, he understood it completely, but just to be totally safe and make sure anyone's comfortable, like, you know, what do you feel comfortable with? Can you look at me even though I'm wearing this wig and have a mustache like you're in love? I know it's an odd thing, but, you know, pretend, think of your crush, or, you know. But yeah, for 2B, Anna and Maya go into more mature sexual places. And so we used 2 adult actors for those characters.
And at any given point, how many parents or handlers are there on set at any time?
A lot.
Because also of the kid extras. There are a lot of parents. So then there are parents of the kid extras and right? Like I would say, yeah, the whole cast.
Yeah. I feel like I have to kind of fight my own brain from constantly asking everybody if they need something, because I'm like so terrified that all of a sudden they're going to be like, my kid's not doing this. But so far, everything's, I think because of the amount that we talk about things, so far, everybody, you know, knock on wood, has expressed comfort and even annoyance with how much we try to talk about things. You know, I'm like such a therapy nerd. So there's a lot of, you know, boundary talk. And, you know, with Brendan and the first kiss of Brendan and Anna, we were both like so intense, being like, this is my boundary. This is, I'm not walking past here, you know? And it lends itself, fortunately, to the awkwardness of that age, because, you know, just me like moving my shoulder a little bit more close to him, even though we're 3 feet away, is a huge move in that moment. You know, so thankfully we get to play with that kind of physicality and then use, you know, our adult body doubles for the most part to do the heavy lifting, shall we say?
And so there's all of that. And then you only have a certain amount of time with the kids on set because they have to do schooling anyway. Yeah. Do you guys have friends who are amazed that you actually get anything done at all on this show?
Yeah, our line producer and AD and
everyone. Yeah.
And us, you know, there's so much rewriting of scenes because of kid hours, and there's so many.
And it was even harder this year because last year we did it in the summer, so we had a little bit more time with them. Then this year we started in the school year, so we had no time. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, it's been and we had no idea what we were in for, you know, because we hadn't done this before with kids when we writer's room or show ran. So it has been a huge learning curve every step of the way to see the boxes that we wrote ourselves into just from the frame of the show production wise. I mean, I couldn't have ever really imagined how hard it would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So see, you mentioned season 2B gets a little bit more explicit, you know, in a perfect world and the show is able to continue, there's a vaccine, et cetera. Do you have an idea for how long you'd like to see the show go? I mean, are they eternally in seventh grade just forever? I mean, I remember seventh grade, it did feel like eternity, but do you have a plan to see them, you know, move on to high school, et cetera?
I mean, creatively, the premise was always that they remain in seventh grade, that we're seeing, you know, these girls develop sort of from the beginning of seventh grade to the end of seventh grade, which means, you know, in our minds, you could see them start as children in a way, go through tweenhood, and then become kind of teenagers by the end because of what they're exposed to or just how they're growing up. And so in my mind, and we are constantly talking about it, I think I always saw this show as a short show, like not a long, you know, running 7 season, 10 season. I don't think that would be overstaying our welcome. I think this is, you know, because they stay in seventh grade, I've always looked at it as like 3 seasons. I don't know about you, Anna.
Yeah. No, we've talked about it a lot. I think, you know, we both kind of acknowledge that you never know, even before the pandemic, you never know how we'll creatively feel, but that trying to put everything in these 3 arcs, story arcs, everything that we really wanted to say for now.
Also, you know, getting so old. That. Sorry, I interrupted you, but we're getting old. We don't want to be, you know, 40 playing these 13-year-olds with, you know, the same cat. It just wouldn't work. Sorry, keep going, Anna. I interrupted you.
Oh, no, I was just saying so that, I don't remember what it was.
I'm
saying.
Sorry.
It doesn't matter. No, it's okay.
That creatively we wanted to be open to it, that it's something if it sparked us, you know.
Oh, yeah.
At one point we talked about doing a season, what if Maya and Anna are in a retirement home, you know, and that's the season. Like that.
Yeah, and we're surrounded by real elderly people.
Would also watch that.
Okay, great. So it's on the table. No, but yeah, there's kind of, we wanted to just make sure that it was, that what we wanted to say for now is in there. So we hope that the end of the third arc will feel somewhat complete, but that's also not to say that we wouldn't ever keep going.
And by third arc, you mean 2B or?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know how to talk about it. 2B, yeah.
It's hard.
And I think it's also true that, you know, we've been working on this, even though it was in our living room for most of the time since we were 25, going back to the log line, being women in, you know, their mid 20s. And we're playing 13, you know, and as things happened, it's a wonderful challenge. And I think it's probably why people are experiencing this season as darker. It's a wonderful challenge to like stay creatively stimulated by playing a 13-year-old. And so that's been great. And then also it's like, how long do we do this for? We had an experience this year that, you know, dark, tragic, we're adults, things happen. And then all of a sudden I'm playing a 13-year-old that's, you know, obsessing over a boy. And I was like, I don't want to do this today. You know, there's bigger things going on. But that's probably going to happen in any character in any show. But those are things we've been talking about, too.
And just as a last question before you guys become a pumpkin, we always like to end the interviews with the same question. What have you guys been watching and enjoying lately?
I have been watching, I just finished rewatching Sopranos, and then I've been getting on into Alone. And then I'm also show. Watching The Vow on HBO. Are you guys watching that? Oh my God. Oh my God.
I haven't. I'm so behind with everything entertainment or pop culture, anything. But I did watch Unorthodox.
Oh, how was it? I heard it's great.
Oh, I loved it. I was sick for a week and was like, I was fine, by the way. Like, you can't just say that on a podcast. But watched it all in a night, and I absolutely loved it. I was blown away. It's just so, you have to watch it, Maya. It's just so specific. I mean, we talk about trying to hold up a mirror to,
and that
like
does.
Life, all the, yeah, to me, I mean, not, it's a life that I know nothing about, but the specificity was just really, I felt like I was encroaching on somewhere I wasn't supposed to be, which is my favorite feeling.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time out.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Stay safe.
The first half of Pen 15's second season is now streaming on Hulu.
Number 5.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner. You know, next week, Dan, would traditionally have been the official start of the 2020-2021 fall TV season. Instead, you're getting a mixed bag of stuff and a lot of streaming things. So you just heard our interview about season 2 of Pen 15 that launches this Friday. Ryan Murphy's latest Netflix original, Ratched, makes its debut. HBO launches Agents of Chaos. And then Fox airs Filthy Rich, which was picked up over a year ago and was supposed to air last season and then held until now because of the pandemic. So, Dan, what you got?
Might as well start with Filthy Rich because it's pretty much the only trace of a normal fall premiere schedule that we're getting next week. It's also being held for whenever it's being held because it wasn't very good. It is somewhat oddly one of two Fox shows that got picked up based on international formats about siblings who didn't know they were siblings discovering their siblings. And to the credit of Filthy Rich, it is less overtly disgusting than Almost Family. So big old huzzah to that. It also has a very good top line cast. I always loved Gerald McRaney. Kim Cattrall is terrific. I thought it was pretty bad, and particularly the supporting performances, I thought were almost shockingly top to bottom amateurish, and that shouldn't really be happening on a broadcast show that is, well, now it's premiering in fall. If it had just been dumped in April or May, because last year it would have been dumped in April and May. Now, as I said earlier, I think April and May, everyone's got to have programming. Maybe you wouldn't care it as much, but man, a lot of these supporting performances on this show are real duds. And in general, the premise is not particularly funny, not particularly dramatic. Tate Taylor, the director of The Help, directed it. It has no particular tone. It's just sort of soapy, but not funny or dramatic. Anyway, I've now said way too much about Filthy Rich because it is not good. And it's also not interesting. In contrast, Ryan Murphy's Ratched is unquestionably interesting. It is definitely a show that you will watch and raise your eyebrows, and the primary reaction will be, what the hell was anyone thinking? Because the show, which was created by Evan Romansky and Ryan Murphy, who developed it, is set up as a prequel to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So it's supposed to be the how did Nurse Ratched become Nurse Ratched question. Now, for one thing, I love One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, both the book and the movie. I never at any point stopped and thought, man, how did Nurse Ratched become Nurse Ratched? That really, to me, kind of goes against the exact nature of that character, who is designed as kind of the background-free embodiment of institutional coldness and disinterest. She's the person who's supposed to have empathy in a business that is sadly without empathy. And I never once stopped and went, huh, where did that lack of empathy come from? Well, apparently Ryan Murphy did, and it has absolutely nothing to do with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I mean that seriously. Like, the best way to approach this really is to not pay any attention to what it's a prequel to, and to just accept that Ryan Murphy is fascinated, and for some logical reasons, with the idea of what the mental health industry has done over the years, over its history, specifically to women and to members of the LGBTQ plus community. And the notion that certain things over decades and centuries have been coded as mental illness and how those things have been treated. It actually is a genuinely fascinating subject. And he touched on it, obviously, in the American Horror Story Asylum season, and also to a slightly lesser degree and slightly less remembered degree in the second season of Scream Queens. So he's kind of going back to that well here. And there's no influence from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest at all. The influences are Alfred Hitchcock and Douglas Sirk and pulpy horror films. And it is all over the map, totally. Sometimes it's melodramatic, sometimes it's campy, sometimes it's straight up hilarious. There is a monkey, which will automatically get at least an extra star from me. It took me a long time to get over the fact that none of it makes any sense in the context of what it's supposed to be a prequel to. I was never bored by it, and so there's something to be said for that. Sarah Paulson is very good. She's always very good. Some of the supporting performances are a lot of fun. Judy Davis is having fun. Sharon Stone is having fun. If you stick around long enough, Soki Okonedo comes in and chews so much scenery for like 2 to 3 episodes. It is impressive to watch. I don't think it's good. I think it is way too confused by what it's trying to be to actually be a good show. But people will have reactions to it, and some of them might be positive. So there's that. Let's see. Well, Hulu's Penis. I like Hulu's Penis. That's just well established.
I would make a title of your sex tape joke, Dan, but it's just such low hanging fruit.
Oh boy, am I not commenting on any of this. Hulu's Pen 15 launches its second season on Friday, and you just heard our interview with Anna and Maya, and it is a sham that Anna and Maya were not nominated for more awards for the first season. The performances they're giving, these two, as they say, 30-something actresses playing 13-year-olds in 2000, going through the travails and awkwardness of junior high, they are great, committed, crazy, manic, grounded, authentic performances. They are all over the map, and they land every punch, as opposed to Ratched. That would be a contrast I would make, is Pen 15 is trying to do a bunch of things, and every single one of them, it largely succeeds at. The second season is maybe not quite as ha-ha-ha-ha-ha funny as the first season, and it's a different kind of cringiness, but it is so relatable and so warm and human and awkward in the ways that it's supposed to be. I just admire what they're doing on this show so much. And if you are a person who did theater as a kid, there is an arc this season where every single beat is going to ring exactly the way you remember it. It captures an experience perfectly. And then there are kind of high flying episodes. You heard us discuss it with Anna and Maya previously. The third episode brings witchcraft into the fold. Why does it bring witchcraft into the fold? It makes sense in context. So I really love this show, and it makes me a little bit sad that the delay to the second half of the season is going to be a long one. But, you know, these 7 episodes they hold together fairly well.
It's so good. If you like, I love season one. And again, I'm not a critic, so make of this what you will, but I love season one. Season two, it's to me, it's so much more ambitious and it just sticks the landing so well. And even though it is, you know, designed as a half season, it still has a fitting end to, you know, it does feel like kind of a mid-season finale, but also, but it works very, very well. And I'm not going to spoil anything.
You will not get to the seventh episode here and feel like you're being left hanging and like you're nervous and anxious to get to whatever the next half of the season is. If someone told you we only did seven episodes this season, here are the seven episodes, you would feel like this was a good contained seven episode season. You would just wonder why they only did seven episodes. So, so that is easily the best thing you can watch this week. And then next week, HBO premieres Agents of Chaos, which is the latest film from the one-man documentary factory that is Alex Gibney. This is one that he directed himself. Sometimes he merely produces. And it is yet another attempt to grapple with the events surrounding the 2016 election. What actually happened with the intelligence community? What did they miss involving the Russians, involving hackers? How much did hackers interfere with the election? How much did they impact the election? It's very in-depth, as you would expect from Alex Gibney. It's fairly dry, as you would also generally expect from Alex Gibney. And it fills you with whatever the discomfort is that it's supposed to. Between this and Showtime's The Comey Rule, there are a lot of people trying to make sure that everybody understands that regardless of what exactly happened in 2016, something happened and it wasn't good for American democracy. And that has nothing to do with how you feel about the results of the election. It has to do with how you feel about the idea that a foreign power attempted to impact our election, which is not a thing that's good. So, yeah, I maybe wanted it to be a little bit more definitive on things, and it might be a tiny bit all over the place, but it definitely does a good job of summarizing a rough handful of years and saying, seriously, pay attention to what's happening in your democracy or else it could vanish without your noticing it. So pay attention, vote, et cetera, et cetera. That's Agents of Chaos premiering next week.
Please vote. I'd like to see Dan and hug him again, please. Thank you. Please vote. Thank you.
Is voting going to magically make this whole virus thing disappear, or is it just going to make us feel better about the world? Anyway, who knows, but vote.
Vote. Well, for more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to THR's Now See This newsletter.
And that feels like a good place to wrap things up. As always, thank you for listening to TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
We'll be back next week when we'll be joined by Fargo showrunner Noah Hawley. And as a reminder, if you like us, please continue to spread the word and let THR know. As we've discussed on the show for months, the industry is changing every day, and we are not immune from joining Stumptown and being unrenewed.
So until then, you can subscribe to us on all of your various podcasting platforms. We appreciate all of you guys who have in recent weeks rated us and written little reviewy things. It really does help spread the word of mouth. We are always happy to see you guys on Twitter and to hear your questions, comments, and concerns. And if you've got queries for an upcoming mailbag segment, you can always just email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5@thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.